Welcome to Building the Future, hosted by Kevin Horick. With millions of listeners a month, Building the Future has quickly become one of the fastest rising programs, with a focus on interviewing startups, entrepreneurs, investors, CEOs, and more. The radio and TV show airs in 15 markets across the globe, including Silicon Valley. For full showtimes, past episodes, or to sponsor the show, please visit buildingthefutureshow.com.
Do you have an app idea that you've been dreaming about but don't know how to actually start building it? Use Bubble. I've been using Bubble for a number of years now. It's an extremely powerful no-code platform that enables you to build, launch, and scale real products without investing thousands of dollars on engineers, designers, or spending time trying to code it yourself. Use Bubble's visual drag-and-drop tool to create really anything from marketplaces, SaaS products, and so much more. Join over 2 million people, including myself, already using Bubble to launch and grow businesses. Welcome back to the show. Today we have Tarun Gupta. He's a partner at Jump Capital. Tarun, welcome to the show.
Hey, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you on the show. I think what you guys are doing at Jump Capital, and specifically the fintech space, whereas one of your specialties, is actually really interesting and cool and kind of in a unique time in history. But maybe before we get into all that, let's get to know you a little bit better and start off with where you grew up.
Yeah, so I was born in New York, born in New York City, lived there for a couple of years before moving to the suburbs, handful of years in the greater New York area before going to high school in Boston. Okay. Spent a couple of years there and then out of nowhere found my way to the Midwest, Michigan undergrad. Was at the Ross School of Business, studying a whole host of different things, but ended up really focusing in on finance there before making my way to Chicago to start my professional career.
Okay, so what made you want to go into business, specifically finance?
Yeah, so business was kind of something that was rooted in me at a very early age. Both my parents were actually business school professors, that kind of drives things quite a bit, although both of them were in marketing. So I think maybe there was a little bit of a rebel in me that was like, okay, I got to find something that isn't marketing if I'm going to do business. The finance side of things, honestly, really just circumstantial. I ended up linking up with Bank of America in a credit risk role as one of my like internships, I believe right after my junior year. And that kind of provided the foundational jumping off point for me to get into financial services, investing as a true like career option.
Very cool. Okay. So walk us through your career, maybe some highlights along the way up until joining Jump Capital.
So I started in investment banking right out of college. I think a lot of students in business school, at least back then, consulting and investment banking were kind of the routes that you took, the default paths if you weren't truly sure what you wanted to do career-wise. And so worked at a small middle market investment bank in Chicago, focused on M&A sell side advisory work, just helping advise companies as they were trying to sell and get acquired. Investment banking is a very unique job. The grind, the hours, all of that is very real, but it provides a very good foundational skill set. You get to really learn about businesses, get to really learn about deal transaction processes, and really build really solid foundational skills in Excel, PowerPoint, storytelling, et cetera. So I think it was a really good base for me. And then at one point I sort of came to the realization that as interesting as components of the job were, there was something missing for me. And I wanted to be a little bit more involved in the actual investment making decision process on who you acquire and why, which is why I then moved over to a publicly traded company called Scientific Games, which is in the casino game and sports betting space on their corporate development team. So I helped them over the course of 4 years acquire 8 different businesses across the various product lines of the business. And so it's across casino games, sports betting, they had a lottery business and a mobile free-to-play business in social games. So really, really interesting industry to be a part of, really interesting experience, and had a really great 4 years there. And then came to a realization after that period of time that as interesting as that was, I wanted to work with founders and businesses at an earlier stage and actually help them grow throughout their life cycle as opposed to sort of being their exit, which is what led me to venture capital and was very fortunate that sort of the jump opportunity worked out as I was looking.
Okay, very cool. So walk us through the types of investing that Jump Capital does, and then let's get into your specialty in fintech.
Yeah, so Jump has been around for about 11 years. Okay. Chicago-based venture firm, typically focusing on leading Series A rounds. We typically write initial checks in that like 5 to 10 million range. I like to think of us as broken up into two sort of segments. So roughly 50% of what we do is fintech financial services oriented, which is where I sit and spend all of my time now. The other 50% is more general enterprise vertical software investments. And that can be stuff in general workflow automation, corporate learning, et cetera. And so we're investing out of our seventh fund, which we closed in fall of 2021, which is a $350 million vehicle. So fortunate in timing and all of that, and very active right now looking to make new investments despite sort of the economic environment that we're in. We're a small team, roughly 12 people, and we're very operating centric at heart. And so what that means is that most of the team, whether you're operating team or investing team, has come from working in a company in some form or fashion. And then our operating folks specifically work really, really closely with our company's post-investment across a couple of key different pillars. And the ones that stand out for us are go-to-market, so helping companies with all things related to thinking about like sales team, sales playbooks, ICP, stuff like that, to the talent side of things around hiring, org structure, culture, and actually managing all that as a lot of teams now become remote and distributed. And then the last piece is around sort of strategic finance. So we look to work really closely hand-in-hand with our companies post-investment.
Okay, very cool. So walk us through kind of the types of fintech companies maybe you've invested in and maybe some that you're looking to maybe invest in, or types of ideas for maybe the listener.
Yeah, and we're very sort of thesis thematically driven in how we invest. So the way I like to think of it is we are very proactive as opposed to reactive in the conversations we have with startups. Yes, of course, we leverage our network and utilize that to help us get into the best deals. But we do a lot of work understanding subsegments of a market before we proactively go and find a company that is sort of quote unquote disrupting in that space. So to give an example in the fintech domain, we invested and led a Series A in a company called AcreTrader in early 2021. That deal came from doing a lot of background work on the alternative asset space and understanding which forms of alternative assets were really attractive. So we went through a whole deep dive in the category, determined that farmland, in our view, is one of the most attractive asset classes that accredited investors had meaningful appetite for, but had difficulty accessing. And we then went and proactively found the handful of companies that were building solutions in that space to make it easier to invest in farmland. And AcreTrader ended up being the one that sort of blew us away, one, from the product, and two, really from the team and sort of the unique founder market fit that we always look for. The founder there has this really unique blend of having worked in financial services, but also grew up in the ecosystem on a farm and was able to sort of build those really deep relationships with farmers that you need to be able to make this business super successful.
Interesting. Okay. So what does Series A traditionally mean to Jump Capital? Because, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, it seems like depending on which coast or where in the middle of America, Series A can mean a bunch of different things. Because you kind of said 5 to 10, I think, earlier. But is that kind of your range? Or what's your range? Or what would Jump Capital consider somebody Series A and actually potentially invest in?
Yeah, it's gotten kind of blurred over the past couple of years what sort of nomenclature is for the various rounds. When we think of Series A, there are a couple of things that come to mind. One, some indication of product market fit. Okay. It could be revenue. We generally look to see the businesses are roughly at that $1 million revenue ARR mark, or it could be just a meaningful base of customers, if you're not quite at that million in revenue yet, that show that there is truly appetite and adoption for the solution that you're building. And then the 5 to 10 that I quoted was sort of our typical check size. So businesses that are typically looking for a meaningful infusion of capital to accelerate their trajectory. So they've found something, some level of fit in the product and adoption from customers that they want to pour, you know, some more fuel on the fire to accelerate things, whether that's go to market specific, whether that is building more components of the product, those kind of inflection points are what we look for when we lean in and invest.
Okay, that makes sense. So I'm curious, because obviously we all kind of heard that especially fintech, especially crypto is getting crushed right now, and kind of the tech space is a little bit negative right now. How do you see the state of, you know, fintech, the investment community, and maybe just as a whole? And then maybe like, where are some places where, you know, you're seeing some positive stuff happening? Because like, yeah, I think it's really easy to go negative.
Yeah, and there's already a lot out there on the negative side of things, and some of it obviously justified. I'll take sort of the more positive side of things. I think that everyone overextended themselves a little bit the past couple of years in how they were looking at opportunities, how opportunities were priced, and how quickly people moved in investing in new companies. I think the positive on the time that we're in right now is that you actually have time to get to know founders, to get to really understand their businesses before you invest. And I think that is beneficial both ways. One, from an investor standpoint, of course, you're not getting into these situations where someone has a term sheet and you have like a week after first meeting to make a decision. You actually have, you know, potentially months. And that's obviously good for us because we get to go as deep as we want, fully understand the business, the market, and our sort of unique advantage if we were to partner with that company. But I think it's also really beneficial for founders. I think over the past couple of years, there were probably a lot of instances that people took on money from venture firms and they didn't fully appreciate what it was like to work with that specific partner or that specific group because they had only gotten a chance to know them over a couple of weeks. In this instance, you get to know and see how someone can add value to your company over a longer time horizon so that when they actually invest and are part of your cap table and potentially on your board, there's no surprise. You know what it's like to work with them and you're excited to work with that person for hopefully, you know, 5 to 10 years. So that's the positive spin that I would take on things as it relates to this specific environment. In terms of areas that we are particularly excited about right now, I would say one that comes top of mind is anything in and around the compliance ecosystem. And that is for a couple of reasons. One, I think we're seeing a lot of regulatory pushing in this specific space, whether it is partner banks and fintechs and that ecosystem getting a lot more scrutiny than it did before, whether it's whatever will come out, right, of sort of the chaos we're seeing from SVB and the likely additional oversight regulators were put on that side of the financial ecosystem. I think it's a really unique time for startups to be building in the compliance space. And the other piece that we look at and why we're so excited is compliance is a must-have type tool. It's not a nice-to-have. You have to be compliant. You have to adhere to what the regulators are saying. And especially in this environment where companies are, you know, thinking about how to differentiate, we think actually one of the unique ways they can differentiate is on their level of compliance and how strong they are in that realm. And that can actually help change compliance from being viewed as a cost center to a way that they can actually win new business.
Okay. Give me an example of that. Cause that's like, that's an interesting thought, I guess, that I never really thought about.
Yeah. So in the like B2B realm, I'd say it's a little tangential to like, if you have SOC 2 certification, then other businesses are really excited about working with you, right? Or at least you have that like baseline level of clearance. So in this instance, if you are in like a B2B setting, you have a certain level of like compliance and thresholds that you are meeting, and you're using certain software tools that are better than the typical manual processes that exist today for a lot of the compliance tasks that exist, you can showcase to the potential customers that you're going to work with, hey, I'm at this level, I'm using these tools, my fraud rates are well below average, whatever the right metric might be, and that could help you win business in that realm. The other side of it, if you're talking from a consumer standpoint, is you've seen, without naming specific names, there are neobanks out there, right, that have seen pretty high fraud rates, and that actually has resulted in consumers who had obviously great value onboarding in a really fast manner, no longer being able to use their debit card or credit card at certain institutions in ways they thought they would want to. And so now, like, that's a huge problem for them, right? And so if you can showcase to consumers that, hey, like somehow we've achieved certain level of thresholds where this isn't going to happen to you, that could help you pull business away from some of the legacy players that, you know, are running into some issues right now.
Yeah, that's interesting. Considering like, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, it's usually a lot of like fintech, especially kind of the banking space, seems to be pretty far behind and in adoption of tech. I think it's starting to speed up. Do you agree with that?
I think it's starting to speed up. I think my view of the past 5 to 10 years is most of the tech adoption in that space was very front end focused. Okay. It was very customer acquisition, pure sales, immediate revenue generation was the priority. I think what we're seeing now is that there's a lot more of a focus on making sure the underlying infrastructure of how you set up your whole tech stack, that has become prioritized. And we also think that other tools, we'll go back to the compliance side for a second, things that were thought of more as cost centers are being prioritized a bit more, or will be, because we view them as true differentiation points and not just, you know, something you need to have playing around in the background.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. That's interesting. So I'm curious, is there specific things that you maybe look for in a company? You kind of talked about a thesis a little bit earlier, but I want to dive a little bit deeper into, like, what are you really looking for in a company outside of kind of just the million-dollar milestone or some traction? What else can people kind of expect from you guys to do when you're doing due diligence?
Yeah, so I'd say a couple of things, and we'll keep the metrics to the side because that's fairly standard. One for us is understanding the market tailwinds behind your business. A lot of what we are looking for is, there are a lot of great ideas that exist out there, but timing really is everything. So why is this solution super relevant now? And what is happening in the broader economy that is going to push this to the forefront, that will force your ideal customer profile to actually adopt this with frequency, and then makes your solution a must-have as opposed to a nice-to-have? So that's like one piece of it. The other piece is around the founders that we partner with. And there are a couple of things there. One is looking to see that they have a unique viewpoint and unique level of knowledge in the space that they're building in. So do they either have the right background in financial services for a fintech business, or have they had some sort of exposure to something that gives them a unique angle on how to approach this particular problem? And then in addition to that, we're very, very focused on founders that are really, really good at bringing interesting people around them. I think one of the things that we've really learned from, you know, doing this for a little bit is, it's great to back a founder that seems incredible and knows the space really well, but one person can only take you so far. Even though venture is very much a, you know, founder-driven culture, it's really important to back those individuals who understand their own strengths and weaknesses and are able to supplement themselves and bring on really high quality talent around them and are comfortable like deferring to those people. And so that's another thing we really look for in the people that we end up backing.
How do you determine that though? Because that's gotta be really hard. Like, are you physically spending time with the founder and their kind of core C-suite team, for lack of a better term for it? Or how do you figure that out? Because that's really challenging.
So I think it's a little bit more doable in today's environment. In 2021, almost impossible to the degree that we would have liked to, just given how fast things would move. Now, there are a couple of different ways. One is, we look to meet founders and their teams in person before we invest. That's sort of a internal criteria for us. And I think it's a really important one, because there's a lot you can learn from someone in person. And two, also that you can learn from them, not on like a Zoom call that is just focused on the business of the company.
Yeah,
we like taking people out to dinner, get a chance to know them, what makes them tick. So that's one piece of it. The other piece is having broader conversations about a business where not only the founder is a participant in that discussion, but a handful of their leadership team is also involved. It's pretty incredible how much you can learn about how everyone on a team works together from an hour call when you dive into their business, where either the founder is dominating the call and they're taking up 50 minutes of the time, versus actually, like, when it's relevant, deferring, quarterbacking to the individuals on their leadership team who have better depth in sales, in product, whatever like the segment might be. So those are just two examples that I can think of.
Interesting. Yeah, I guess like it's all that stuff that really plays into it. Yeah, that's interesting. So how long traditionally would your maybe due diligence process take? Like, obviously, is it like 3 to 5 months, 6 months, a year? Does it really depend on the company? Because now that deals aren't getting signed and you have a 2-week deadline or a week deadline.
Yeah, it varies a lot. I think one of the things that we're seeing right now is there are a lot of interesting companies coming up, but there aren't a ton of like immediate fundings. So companies are kind of deferring, trying to wait for either the market to be in a better place or waiting for their traction to be at a better level that they can combat some of what we're seeing from a market correction standpoint. So the timing varies a lot. Sometimes we work with businesses and get to know them over a 6+ month horizon because they're not looking to raise right now. And then you can build really unique relationships, showcase your value and how you can help them get access to new customers, new potential hires, stuff like that. Other times it's a little bit more imminent where they are raising and you have to sort of go into a process more quickly. And those obviously move at a much, much faster cadence.
Okay, I want to dive a little bit deeper into that first point because I don't think a lot of VC firms actually do that. Is if, I don't know, I have a fintech company, I'm, you know, maybe say I'm $500,000 a year in recurring revenue and I'm on target to maybe hit that 1 million. How do I make that connection to you and start building that relationship and kind of what do you expect for that? And then walk me through kind of what you just said about like maybe helping me, I don't know, build my sales team so I can get that extra, you know, $500,000 for a simple example.
Yeah. So we might be a little different in how we sort of think about this, but again, very proactive. So let's say we built a thesis, we find a subsegment, whether it's in compliance, whether it's in debt management, whatever the category might be. We've identified through that thesis work 5 to 10 companies that we think are super interesting. We have conversations with those companies, and through that, and through sort of our own internal like diligence and understanding of the founder and the market they're going after, we make an assessment on which one of those businesses we think is most interesting and most likely to be the disruptor in that space. Let's say that specific company isn't planning to raise for 6 to 12 months because, as you said, they're 500K-ish of revenue. They want to get to the million mark, or you know, they have cash right now and they want to wait for you know, a handful of other milestones to come through. What we'll do is we'll focus on two primary things. One is just generally staying close, obviously, but two, introducing them to prospective customers.
Okay.
And that has multiple benefits. One, it shows the value that we can add and the value that we are adding when we're not even invested in your business and we're not even on your board yet. So imagine the value we will add once we are. Two, it's actually a great way for us to get validation on if this idea and business is as much of a game changer as we think it is. So the startup gets the value of potential customers coming in the door as potential additional revenue. We get the benefit of our network and the people we know who could be customers for these different solutions coming in, evaluating them, and letting us know if they think it's super interesting or not. And if they sign up, that is the best validation that we can get that this business is really interesting and there might be like meaningful adoption on the horizon. So that's one piece of it. The other piece is around like talent and hiring. And so we look to understand what the potential gaps are on the teams that we work with. It varies obviously by company, but if I were to generalize most of the businesses that we work with, the founders and the early stage teams are very, very strong from like a product and tech perspective, but they usually need a little bit of help on like a sales go-to-market side. So it's potentially helping bring in that first sales hire for them, whether that's head of sales or more of a, you know, sort of junior salesperson to help transition the business from being fully founder-led sales to having like the early signs of a sales org being built. And so we can help supplement that side of things by bringing in the right people and then also helping them think through more sophisticated processes around how to build that go-to-market engine and sales funnel.
Interesting. Okay. What advice do you give to people? Like if I was to cold outreach to you and maybe I'm not ready for a Series A, like how can I start building a relationship with you today? You know, and hopefully in, you know, maybe 3 to 5 years, I will be raising a Series A.
Yeah. So it's funny. I've actually had this happen a handful of times with businesses that we are very much actively tracking. And so the ones that have been most successful, I mean, one, I read every email that I get. So that's it's a personal problem in doing that from a time allocation standpoint. But I think one of the things that has been really successful for founders who have emailed me as inbound is attaching their business and idea to some sort of thesis work that we've done. We usually are relatively outgoing with where we're spending time. So on our website, we have an insights page and we put our areas of focus for the year. We publish sort of our thesis posts and where we're spending time and actively hunting for opportunities. And being able to tie the business that you're building to that thesis is an immediate sort of like click for us and like, okay, we should dive really deep here and see what's going on. So that's really like the first piece of it. And then it kind of varies based on conversations from there.
Okay, interesting. How long or short should that email be?
I wish I had more specific advice, but I wouldn't go super, super like long on the email. I'd say just like a line or two at the intro set of what the business is, maybe a couple of bullets. And if there is like a deck or some sort of material set that you can send over that gives like a better sense of the business, the product, that's usually enough to spur an initial discussion.
Fair enough. Okay. That makes sense. So I'm curious then if I have a fintech company, maybe, and you guys reach out to me, walk us through that process a little bit and kind of what can I expect? And sometimes that's kind of a weird conversation as a founder. I think sometimes it's like sometimes that email from an investor I found, and it almost like is a little bit scary, especially if you've never raised money before, especially if you've been bootstrapping. So walk us through that a little bit.
Yeah. So a couple different ways we handle that. One, wherever possible, we like to leverage our existing network, right? Warm intros are always more powerful than cold outreach. So we try and find, if we find an interesting company and we see someone in our network, whether it's another venture firm, whether it's another startup founder we've backed, or just a larger player in the ecosystem that's connected, we love getting connected through those individuals. That's the priority and the preferred approach. If for whatever reason that isn't a possibility, then yes, cold outreach happens. And maybe I'm in the minority on this, but I actually have found relatively good success with that.
Awesome. That's great.
And for me, the approach has been, and back to your point of like finding like the right like length of these emails, outlining why your firm is unique and why this founder should talk to you. And for me, the approach that has been most effective is outlining our view on their market and why we think their approach is potentially interesting. And so for us, it's always been about identifying like why we have a unique viewpoint and that we understand the market that you're building in. So that when we talk to you, you're not educating us on the market, you're not educating us on the size of the market, who the players are, where it's heading. We, if we've done our homework correctly, we already have a viewpoint on all of that. And the conversation is purely about you, your team, and your product and why you think you're the right group to win in this particular segment.
Interesting. That's actually really rare from a VC standpoint to do that much homework in a market. Usually, in my experience anyway, you're usually as a founder always having to say what you just outlined. So that's pretty cool that you guys are spending that much time and effort in those areas, right? Before you actually reach out to me.
That's the goal. And we think that's one of the ways that we can differentiate ourselves, right? I think I heard it on prior podcasts that you've had with other folks in the venture ecosystem. And I agree. I really do believe capital in and of itself is a commodity. And so venture firms do have to find other ways to differentiate. I think the operating angle that we take and how we lean in and support companies, both pre-investment and post-investment, is one of them. And I think the work that we do from a thesis standpoint to be really educated on the markets that we're interested in, to really facilitate those intro calls with founders, is the other one.
100% agree. So, and you're kind of in a unique spot because you're usually doing Series A, you know, kind of stage investments. But the reality is I think a lot more companies can bootstrap, at least for a period of time, because the cost to build a lot of software is a lot less, and in a lot of cases, like almost very inexpensive, right? With especially some no-code stuff and just, you know, maybe something off the shelf a little bit. But what's your thoughts on, like, when a founder should raise money, or maybe they should just keep bootstrapping? Because I always find it's interesting to ask, like, what's your opinion on when a company should raise money, or should they keep maybe bootstrapping and delay it?
Yeah, I think venture money really only makes sense for a handful of companies, a much smaller universe than maybe most folks truly believe. So I think founders have to be really honest with themselves on what type of business that they're building and the capital needs of that business. If you're trying to build a really, really massive business that requires a meaningful amount of capital and upfront investment to be able to scale to the markets and acquire the customers that you're looking for, and you're okay with, at the end of the day, not owning 100% of that business, then venture might potentially make sense for you. And if you're going through that process, it's very important to understand what happens when a venture investor puts dollars in, how that potentially changes your economics from a return standpoint if the business exits, and what it's like to work with that person over a really long time horizon. There are a lot of other businesses that, frankly, either don't need that level of capital, or the founders just want more holistic control of their business and want to own 100, or if it's not 100, like a very, very large stake in that company, as opposed to what happens in venture businesses where, you know, everyone gets diluted round over round. And so I think that's sort of the first thing that you need to be like honest about is like, are you really building a business where venture makes sense, and understanding the pros and cons of taking venture dollars and what that means for you?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I'm curious, is there a range of equity you guys are kind of looking to take? And then does that include a board seat? Yes or no? Is that kind of up for debate?
Yeah. So in the Series A's, we like to lead where possible. When we do lead those rounds, we do typically take a board seat, and we are targeting, call it roughly 15% okay. ownership. For us, it's to make sure the fund economics work, but it's also, we want to have a meaningful stake in a business and be represented on the board because we put meaningful resources into every company that we invest in. And it just, if you're going to put the full team behind an investment, which is what we do, even though there's technically one partner that's kind of the deal lead, the sponsor, and sort of holds the main point of communication, our full team comes behind every single investment that we make. And it just makes sense that way if we get to that 15% and have a board seat.
Okay. So if you're the lead on, say, the fintech deals, when you're evaluating, are you pitching the other verticals inside of Jump to say, like, is this good? What am I missing? What are the pros and cons of this potential deal? Or is it kind of very like vertical agnostic? Or how does that kind of work?
Yeah. So we're a very collaborative flat team in sort of how we operate. And so any deal that we work on, even if I am the lead, there are at least two, potentially three other people actively involved in that deal with me. And we like to bring in very different sort of points of view. So I always like to have someone from our operating team involved in one of these deals to get their perspective on how they think of a particular business. Depending on the segment and the industry that the business is in, someone else from our team might be a really logical person to pull in because they've had experience in that segment, have looked at other businesses. And so we look to bring our team in holistically to every opportunity. So our core deal teams, or call it somewhere in the 2 to 4 person range. And then we discuss every deal as a full team before we invest.
Interesting. Okay, very cool. So is there geographic regions that you guys traditionally like to invest in, or walk us through that?
Primarily North America. So we'll focus in North America. But within North America, we're pretty open to invest across the US, even though we're, you know, a Chicago-based fund. Yes, if a business is based in the middle of the country and we see like a unique opportunity there, that's awesome. But we will invest across sort of the country. And then we do actually make a handful of investments internationally as well. Those are a little bit more select. The way I think about that is if we build a thesis and we happen to find that the company we're most excited about is based in London, Israel, or some other major market, we're totally okay leaning into those businesses. But we have historically avoided emerging markets, at least for the time being.
Got it. Okay. That makes sense. So I'm curious, because you're focused, well, you specifically in kind of the fintech space, is there any advice or thoughts that you can give people about maybe coming up with an idea based on kind of what you see or predict will be really popular maybe in a few years? Like, does AI play into that? Does crypto play into that? Do you have any predictions on what maybe people can leverage? Like, I get some of this stuff's just buzzwords, like Web3, what does that even mean really to a lot of people? But is there specific things that you could maybe see that you'd maybe say like, yeah, you might want to look at this space? Because we talked about a few, but is there others that you'd maybe give people recommendations for that are maybe like, I really want to build something, but I don't really know what to build yet?
Yeah, I'm happy to take a stab at that. I'm not the most creative person from that standpoint, which is why I'm an investor and not a founder, amongst many other reasons. But one, we already hit on the compliance stuff. I think that is definitely an area of interest for us. And we think there's going to be a lot more regulatory tailwinds that push businesses to think much harder about the compliance solutions they have in-house and how to improve that tech stack. So that's one. The second one is we believe that we are very early in sort of a reset in people's like personal financial lives from like a debt management standpoint. So if you look at all the numbers across what happened during COVID, the level of like delinquency in debt repayment or defaults was kind of at all-time lows. And you're seeing early signs of it starting to tick back up. It's still well below historical levels, but we think that is going to increase pretty meaningfully, unfortunately, given just the economic environment we're in. And so we think that consumers will need better tooling to help them manage their personal financial lives. We also think financial institutions will need more software-driven ways to help them get in front of consumers potentially becoming delinquent, find ways to actually prevent it, and find ways to actually help consumers potentially get on payment plans to sort of meet sort of what they're owed. So that's like another piece that we think is particularly interesting. And then the last one is kind of in the payments realm and very early in this thought process, but FedNow is something that's supposed to go live this year. And having access to real-time money, instant money movement is potentially a game changer in financial services, and looking at all the potential implications of that, whether it's helping build the connectivity so people can get connected to those FedNow rails, whether it's looking at, okay, how does fraud change when money moves instantly? There are a lot of different angles that you can take there, but those are just a couple that are top of mind for me that I think are super interesting.
Interesting. What are your thoughts on kind of AI in the fintech space?
So it definitely has use cases. I think that we are cautiously optimistic about the potential there and very careful when companies throw that word out in their business description to understand what it truly is unlocking and why it's so unique. But I think it definitely has a place to play across the broader ecosystem.
Interesting. No, I agree. I 100% agree with you. I'm curious though, is there, if I'm pitching you guys, is there anything that you expect in a deck? Do you have a deck template that I can follow when I'm pitching Jump? Or walk us through, is there specific things that you need from me if I'm just pitching you guys?
Yeah, we don't have a deck template, but as I think about like the major things, the first piece, even though this is maybe a little bit less relevant for us, you're not building the deck just for us. You do have to hit the market and sort of what that looks like, who the players are, who competition is. That's one piece. Two is hitting around sort of the model, like the product that you have in place and like how you plan to monetize from that business model and why you chose that business model and that sort of pricing structure. Three is around sort of the traction momentum of the business, where you're at from a revenue customer signup standpoint. And then the last piece is just around the team and understanding who the current team is today, why they're their unique group to build this solution, and then also being pretty open about where the gaps are on that existing team and what the key positions are that you need to hire for. And if you're raising and it's a fundraising deck, how much you're looking to raise, why this specific amount of proceeds is the right amount, and what you think those proceeds are going to go to and what that will get you to. Like, does that get you 2 to 3 years worth of runway and takes you from 1 million to 5 million? Or does it give you 5 years of runway because you're incredibly capital efficient and you can scale even further? So those are the various things that we think about or look for in the decks that we review.
Got it. Okay. So because you have quite a big potential range of the Series A funding that you would lead the round on, if you're interested in my fintech company, for example, and say I figure out like I need 3 million or 5 million and we get talking and it kind of comes out like, oh, maybe you need closer to 6 or like 7 or whatever, right? Like it needs to go up or down a little bit. Like, do you work with a founder to kind of maybe figure some of that out? Because I know in the past when I've worked at companies that are pitching, it's like sometimes it's like you guys are not raising enough money. You're raising too much money. And it's such a weird thing as a founder to figure out like where that sweet spot is, and kind of what's your thoughts and how do you work with founders to maybe figure that out, especially if you're going to maybe give them some money down the road?
Yeah, it's a great question. So we look to see that founders have a viewpoint on how much money they need to raise, and they have rationale for why. So that's the first piece. But we do our own analysis and work to determine what we think the appropriate amount is and why. And so if we're getting to that point where we're potentially nearing an investment, we have a very frank discussion with the founder around, hey, you suggested you wanted to raise, in the case that you just mentioned, somewhere in the 3 to 5 range. While in theory, we think that's great, we ran through your financial model, built a bunch of assumptions on how we think you'll scale from a revenue standpoint and what type of expenses and increase in hiring you might need and how that might change sort of your cost profile. Our view based on all of that, and we'll share that, you know, pretty directly with them, is you actually probably need to raise closer to 8 million. We think that gives you the appropriate runway given the revenue assumptions we made, which are X, and the cost assumptions we made, which are Y, to give you 2 to 3 years worth of runway to be able to build your business and go from X million in revenue to Y million in revenue, which will enable you to more successfully raise that Series B. So we look to have pretty frank discussions with founders around that to outline our view. That being said, if there's a pretty dramatic difference in funding, like that it does become a harder conversation, right? If you're talking about raising 3 to 5 and we run our numbers and we think you need 15, that's going to be a really tough conversation. If it's 3 to 5 and we think you need like 7 or 8, that's something that can potentially be bridged.
Okay, fair enough. So you say that you traditionally like to lead around. That's fine, makes total sense. What are you expecting from the other investors that are going to be like after you guys? And the caveat to that is, are you fine leading around even if, you know, it takes me a while to get additional investors? Like the question I guess is maybe better put, like I've had where it's like, we'll lead the round if you find one or two other investors that believe in the idea. And I get that you're Series A, so it's a little bit maybe not relevant, or maybe it is. I don't know. Just trying to figure out where you guys are with the Series A. And I guess it goes back to my earlier comment about Series A seems to mean different things in different parts of the country. So just trying to gauge how you guys would see that and what it really means when you guys mean lead around.
Yeah. When we lead around, we put out the term sheet, which outlines how much capital we think the business needs for this particular round, how much of the round we would take up, and pricing. And that is a commitment from us that if we agree on these terms and everything's signed, that we are going to fund this business for X million dollars. Let's say it's a $10 million round. Let's say we're putting in 7. We're in for 7. The remaining 3 either can come from a segment of your existing investors. Most of the companies we invest in have raised a seed round, so there's some level of existing investors. For the most part, in the A rounds that we lead, the existing investors usually are pretty excited to double down and put more money into the business. And so that remaining, call it 3 mil in this example, gets sort of allocated between the existing investors. If for whatever reason there is still room after that, or in a handful of instances, the founder wants to bring on another party for a specific reason, they add some sort of value that the parties around the table don't currently provide, then we slot someone else in to take a portion of the round because of the unique value that they bring in. So that's how we think about like leading those rounds. And yeah, we issue the term sheet, put everything out there, and commit to funding the amount that we put out there.
Okay, no, that makes sense. How much due diligence do you do on the past investors? Is it relevant at all?
So it's relevant in the sense of it's very helpful to understand those investors' viewpoint on the company, the market, and how they work with their founders. And so we look to build really good relationships across the ecosystem with other seed investors. One, it ends up being a really good ground for sourcing. Like if you've worked with a seed investor multiple times, you like their portfolio, you like how they operate, hopefully you can get an inside track to look at their companies as they come up for Series A. But it is pretty critical to understand how they operate so that if you're sitting on a board with them, you are aligned and you have sort of similar viewpoints. So for sure, it comes into play. And there are instances that go both ways, right? Like you've invested with people who you really like, who you want to make sure you sit on boards in the future. And I'm sure everyone's had instances with people that maybe aren't the best fit or don't think in the exact same way. that maybe aren't the best fit down the road for you to partner with again.
Sure. I'm also assuming that you could potentially recommend a firm in your example, like if you put in the 7 of the 10, that maybe give me that 1 or 3 or some combination of that. You have other firms that you potentially work with that you could bring in as well?
For sure. Yeah. And that's another piece that we hopefully add value into, depending on the business and the subsegment that you're working in. We know the other investors in that space as well, and the ones that we think could be meaningful value adds on your cap table if they were given the chance.
No, that makes a lot of sense. We're kind of coming to the end of the show, but is there any other advice that you would like to pass on to founders or entrepreneurs?
I think just to go back to something you said, it is a challenging environment right now. That being said, I think it presents really unique opportunities to build really interesting solutions. There still is a meaningful need for continued tech innovation. And hopefully it gives founders a chance to really get to know the VCs that they might partner with, and so they can find someone who truly is the best fit for them down the road.
I agree 100%. But I think the caveat to that is, if I have a business that is maybe making some money and doing okay, if the due diligence takes 6 months, it might crush my business. So like, what's your thoughts on kind of that? Like, as a founder, if I'm pitching you guys and for my Series A, and it's like, you'll figure it out. I get that you'll just run some, you know, you'll, during due diligence, you'll figure that out. But how transparent or upfront should I be? It's like, I kind of need money in the next, you know, 60 to 90 days instead of, you know, 6 months, for example.
Yeah. So a bunch of things to unpack there. Just to clarify, the 6 month example I gave is just in an environment where a company doesn't need money right now. If a company needs money immediately, we work on that timeline, right? To get fundings done, right? In a handful of weeks, a month, whatever it might be. In terms of thinking about how you approach investors, I think it's a balancing act. I think you want to get out and have investor conversations reasonably well in advance of when you run out of money, or when you think you're in that like 2 to 3 month timeline of like, I need money. So if you have, let's say, like 16 months of runway left, I would start having those conversations with investors on just starting to get to know them and figure out who you might want to really like have deeper dialogue with in like the next few months, as opposed to waiting for when you only have 6 months of runway to then start those conversations. I would like to think that investors aren't going to take advantage of situations, but that's just not the reality, right? Yeah. And so if you are a company and you only have a couple months of runway left, there's a chance that other investors are going to take advantage of the fact that you only have a couple of months of runway left and squeeze better terms out of you for that, right? That's just a cold, harsh truth. And so you put yourself in a better position if you start those conversations and dialogue when you're not in dire need of money, because then you can dictate the terms and the pace a little bit more.
Okay. So it sounds, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is around that like yearish mark of like, you should probably maybe give or take a few months either way.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Okay. No, that's really good advice. But sadly, we're out of time. So how about we close with mentioning where people can get more information about yourself, Jump, and any other links you want to mention?
Yeah. So for Jump, check out our website, jumpcap.com. You can see the companies we invested in. There's also an insights page, which goes into a bunch of the outward facing content that we put out there. And then you can find both Jump and myself on LinkedIn. And then my email is Tarun@jumpcap.com. Always happy to chat about anything in the ecosystem.
Perfect, Tarun. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to be on the show. And I look forward to keeping in touch with you, and have a good rest of your day.
Thanks, Kevin. You too. Really appreciate the time.
Thank you. Okay. Bye.
Thanks for listening. Please visit our website at buildingthefutureshow.com to join the free community, sign up for our newsletter, or to sponsor the show. The music is done by Electric Mantra. You can check him out at electricmantra.com, and keep building the future.